All of the views and opinions expressed here are those of the individual speaking and may not be representative of Coding American. At times, language may be considered vulgar. Listener discretion is suggested.
You are now listening to the Coding Behind the Wheel podcast.
All right, we're live. Peter Turek, former editor of Modified Magazine, current co-mastermind behind Speed Academy.
Yeah, that's right. There's two of us.
There's two of you.
Yes.
Are you ready for a 10-question quickfire?
I certainly am. Hit me.
All right, let's do it. S13 or S14?
Oh, man. That is a tough one.
I know.
So I've had both, actually.
I know.
I think S14 only just because the easeability for like daily use is there. I find the S13 just to be a smaller car.
All right.
So it's not as practical.
All right.
If you would ever call an S chassis practical, but that's the way my mind works. I'm like, bigger car. And it's still, to me, a little bit better geometry in terms of grip driving. So
solid,
I'd have to say 14,
solid explanation. You know? I like that.
Yeah.
Modified or Super Street Magazine?
that's a tough one. As much as I love Super Street, I'm going to have to go with Modified just because.
Understood.
It hits home, you know?
Yeah. Video or photography?
Oh, photography.
Okay.
Even though I do video.
I honestly thought you were going to go the other route, but.
Nah, you know what? I love taking photos, and I find photos, you could spend so much more time tweaking them and making them look perfect. Mm-hmm. And with video, you pretty much, if you want to make something nice, it's like you got to have a movie style set where you've got lighting and just like getting it all going. Like the kind of stuff I do is just raw almost to that sense. The production value is so low. And I'm like, that's what burns me so much because
I don't think it's that low.
Well, it's low in certain standards, I think. But yeah, you're right. In terms of the vlog, I think it's up there.
Yeah. E46 or E90 BMW?
E46 all the way, man.
For sure. 100%. I'm right with you.
I think that car is the most beautiful BMW, like the M3 ever built.
Oh, yeah. It's one of my favorite.
And they're stupid cheap for prices right now,
goodness. Yeah, just don't get that SMB tranny.
this is just a preview a little. We may have something like that coming down the pipeline for one of the projects. So,
grip driving or drifting?
Man, I love both so much. I definitely don't do enough drifting. So I'm going to have to say grip, but the excitement that you get from drifting, I think, is
pretty
infectious.
Intense.
And it's something that I want to do so much more of. But
oh, I know.
Guys trying to make a channel for the grip guys. So
did you say grip backs?
No, I didn't. Grip guys.
I thought she said we're grip backs. I was like, oh, that's cool. SR20 DET or a K24 turbo?
Oh my God, K24 all day.
Love it.
The K motor, I still maintain is the best NA4 cylinder ever built.
It's a big statement.
I know, but it makes more power than an SR stock with boost.
Yeah.
It makes more power without boost.
Okay.
It can, you can rev it to the moon. You don't need to like do a ton of upgrades on it. They're just like, what other engine can you just make 200 plus wheel horsepower all day long with just bolt-ons? Like it's a tough sell for anything else, in my opinion, right?
All right. I mean, listen, it's a solid supporting argument that you brought up.
I may be biased because I'm putting one in an S14, but...
Right. I know you have a 930 911. So is it a 930 911 or is the 991 911 turbo?
Oh, man. I'd 930 for me.
I thought you were going to be there, but I don't know. I just wanted to see where you're at.
Yeah, I love the new ones are so badass. They're just...
Yeah,
they're just too good to a certain extent. They provide everything so well where mine has character. I was driving it the other day and I got into speeds that were very reckless and the front end starts getting light and it's like, okay, you got to reel it in, you know?
Yeah, you just need more downforce.
Exactly, right? So,
new Civic Type R or the DC2 Integra Type R?
DC2. Yeah, I'm old school.
I love that. Love it. 2JZ or RB26?
Oh, 2J.
And finally, my Canadian friend, is it the poutine or the butter tart?
I'm, I barely ever eat butter tarts, so and I don't eat much poutine, but it has to be poutine. I mean,
right. The national staple of Canada. So throw people a tip. If they're up there in Canada, where do they need to go for their poutine? Is there a spot?
Oh, man. I try to live a healthy life, so I don't get out to too many poutines. But okay. Smokes Poutinerie is kind of our staple. It's almost like a chain around here, but it does have excellent poutine. So if you're not like a crazy food snob, that to me is the way to go. You can enjoy it, have your gravy, and then you can even add ridiculous things like chili, bacon, and a whole bunch of other stuff that I've only seen at like 3 a.m. because that is like the drunk go-to for a lot of people. So those places are open late at night. Yeah,
it's almost like the taco of the Canadian world.
Yeah. You may be right. That is right? A good way to put it. Yeah.
All right.
Loaded these days.
I'm Scott. I'm the marketing director for Koenig Wheels. And today our guest is Peter Turek. Many of you know him from his days as editor-in-chief of Modified Magazine. In 2014, that all changed when Source Interlink, the then owner of Modified Magazine, laid off a bunch of people and killed Modified Magazine in the print form. Peter then went on to co-found the YouTube and online content source Speed Academy. And that is where you can find Pete today with his knowledge of cars and all of its incredible vibes, where it finds its way all over the internet. So thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it. I know you guys are
no problem.
Strapped up. You just came back from a little trip.
Yeah. A little getaway.
Yeah. That's pretty special too. But so I have a problem, and the problem is that I've been trying to shorten these podcasts, and when I sat down to jot some notes down, I realized that I had no shot at making this one short.
People like to listen to long format podcasts, so you're all good.
Yeah, and listen, just a little disclaimer for anybody that's listening, every time I put up a podcast, whether it be on YouTube or if it's in, you know, iTunes or Google Play, in the description area, we do put a time code cheat sheet, so you can jump around.
Oh, that's good.
And I try to outline the topics just because, I mean, we all are busy. So to be able to, you know, skip around, hear what you're looking for, that's not so bad. But I want to start out by giving you some praise. I was thinking about this a lot when I was trying to put some thoughts together. I really have so much respect for the risk that you took in trying to get Speed Academy going. Now, I have an intimate piece of this because I remember all of this happening in real time. We spoke so many times.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
In between, you know, you kind of getting going. And it was just, you know, it's easy to look in hindsight, right? It's easy to go through things, but there's two major pieces of this. One, you were able to not just run and take another job. See, that's the piece. You know, when you just lose everything in one day, and you had plenty, you had plenty of offers. It wasn't like you didn't have, you're like, well, what do I do now? It was a question of, yeah, first off, I believe they offered you, right, at the time.
That's
Source, right?
It was still Source, yeah.
So they offered you a job and you were just like, all right, we're done. I've had enough.
Yeah. No, it was certainly a tough decision. I mean, but, you know, sometimes something runs its course. And I felt like the magazine business at that point, I already knew when they had changed, like our publisher, we originally were working with Maria Jameson and she was absolutely fantastic.
She's
and
great.
She moved on and they brought in somebody that was, you know, a little less inexperienced, had more knowledge in the motorcycle realm. And then things just started getting dicey where covers, before it was always like, there was a struggle, what was going on the cover and, is this not going to go? And I had actually done a dual cover of a Resto Mod domestic car, and I think it was an FCRX 7. Okay. And I was like, there's no chance in hell they're going to approve this cover. And there was not a peep out of anybody that that there was an issue with this. And I was like, this is kind of like the beginning of the end. I knew that something was coming because of that, because it was just, you know, when they stop caring about what you're doing.
I know, then, it's true. But, you know, you also did one other thing that, to me, was one of the biggest pieces, is that go back to 2014, you understood, you had the foresight and the fortitude to really look forward and say, okay, there's something here with this YouTube online content model. But it wasn't like it is today. It wasn't like everybody aspired to be a social influencer and they knew this monetization thing was a route to make a viable living. Like you were able to see that then. I mean, maybe not to the extent that if you looked back at it now, you could say, oh, well, there's these pieces, of course. But you were able to basically stop everything you had done for the past 10 years and say, there's another route here. I don't exactly know what it is, but I'm going there. And I honestly, I look back and I don't think I could have done it. So I think you're owed a lot of credit for that.
No, thank you. That I certainly appreciate that. You know, it's funny because when Dave and I originally started talking about this, we thought a blog was the way to go because it was still online print media. Speed Hunters was such a huge thing.
Right.
And, but then we looked at that and said, you know what? People, and it kind of stemmed from the magazine world, people don't necessarily want to read.
No,
that was our biggest thing. We thought, you know what? People weren't reading the magazines anymore. They just wanted to see pictures. Like we went from, you know, when I started working at the magazine, I think 2003,
right.
We were probably writing anywhere from 1500 to 2000 word feature stories.
Right.
And when they were closing the magazine, we were down to like 500 to 750 just to keep these things. People just wanted to see photos. Right.
Yeah.
And that was the big thing. It was like this kind of shift in evolution. And I thought, well, from a website perspective, a blog, it'll be good for kind of how to's, but not really like episodic project car builds and really talking about parts that we feature and whatnot. So we thought the best thing to do is to look at YouTube. And truth be told, I wish I would have done that 5 years prior to where we were, man. Cause you know, even when we came in and I appreciate what you said, I still feel like we were behind the curve. If we had done it 2-3 years before then, we would be so much further ahead right now. It's like the bell curve, right? Where everyone's getting in.
Yeah.
But that's
like trying to buy Facebook stock, right?
Yeah,
it's really easy. It's really easy to go back and say, well, they opened at 20, dropped to 18.
Yeah.
And if I had just bought when, even it was at 130, I mean, now it's up to what, 170, 180 or something like that. So, I mean, I guess so. You know, and the other thing that I don't want to do is I don't want to go too much further without mentioning Dave, right? So Dave Pratt, I've known him probably just as long. Back in the modified vertical scope days. And he's the other co-founder. And the reason, just to be totally up there, is you and Dave, because I know you both personally, you each have your own story to tell. And I didn't want to put you guys on the Speed Academies here. I wanted to let each one of you. So I had told Dave, we're going to do an interview with Dave at a later date. So of course, this one's going to be biased towards you, but I don't want people to have any diminished idea that
Dave
wasn't
involved. The pretty face in the videos.
He's gorgeous.
That's all he is. Yeah.
Yeah. He's really good looking. Yeah. We share the same hairstyle for the most part.
You do.
Oh man. So listen, you're here at a good time. We have a few of these podcasts under our belt and we've kind of graduated from that area of, I wonder how it's going to go to let's try and not make it suck so bad.
Yeah.
So it's a good time to be here. You know, this is exciting.
I always like doing these things.
Right. Well, you're right. There's nothing to do in your free time, so you figured, I'll just go on.
These are nice because compared to the production work that I have to put into a video, it's sometimes just really great to sit down and chat, right?
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that there's a ton of stuff people can learn, not just by hearing your story, but from some of the experiences you've had. And that's always my biggest piece with these, is that there's so much out there. Maybe even, you know, and it's hard to think that we're a little bit older generation now. It doesn't feel that way.
But no, then I speak to people, yeah.
And I go, oh, wait, I have been doing this for like.
Yeah. Jeez, I've been to SEMA 15 years now. Oh, jeez. Right?
Right. So that gets tough. I want to give people a little context as to how we know each other. I've personally known you for probably at least over 10 years.
Yeah.
Verticoscope, Modified Days. People that don't know, Modified Magazine originally was based in Canada.
That's where correct, you're from. Toronto. Yeah.
Right. We always have solid conversations, whether it be catching up at SEMA or grabbing each other on the phone for a few minutes in between kind of planning something that we're doing, whether it be through Speed Academy or then in the magazines. So I also thought it was an interesting thing. You're like a legit car guy, not the guy that was brought in to write about cars, that learned about cars by writing about cars. You're that full-fledged engine swap, custom wiring, standalone ECU car guy. So yeah. I want people to hear what first brought you to cars, period.
You know, I've always been attracted to cars. I think you start just at such a young age and you start playing. Like Transformers to me were the coolest thing ever, you know, and I think there was G.I. Joe. They were cool, but automobile thing with the Transformers, to me, I was just enamored by it. And I think that's kind of where it all started. And then growing up, I was always tinkering on cars with my dad. We didn't really have a lot of money, so he was always buying shit boxes, and which meant they were sitting things in the driveway. And exactly. And there was always things to fix. And I'm a tinkerer to a certain extent. Like my dad is an engineer, and I kind of have that same gene. I love to build. I love to work. I love the reward aspect of putting something together and then seeing the performance difference and whatnot. And cars kind of are that outlet. And I kind of say around, you know, 16 years old when I got my license is really when the car thing hit. I was into bikes, like mountain bikes. I was like, oh man, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. Like mountain bikes are awesome. And then the first time I could drive, the bike was like in the shed. Ironically, the first car I had was a 1G DSM, a Plymouth Laser.
It's like, and so that's where we got, it's the same start I have.
The common link, man.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing because
you know what?
I love them, but there was this love-hate relationship.
See, and I think that's the problem. Everyone always says that. And I now have such a love for DSMs because if you look back, those cars were just like ahead of their time. 100% they were. Like there was nothing on the road that would touch that car from, you know, a four-cylinder all-wheel drive standpoint. Like no other manufacturer was pumping this type of car out. And not even that, like you could spend the price of a little aquarium valve to go and set up a manual boost controller and get so much more power to that thing, put an exhaust on it. Like, and those are the key elements that you do these days that to me as a child, you know, as a teenager, I guess, growing up, like that was so new and foreign. It was so awesome. And every other car, like, oh, a Civic made, you know, whatever, 4 horsepower, you put an intake on it and a loud exhaust did nothing. But the DSM, like, oh my God, it was phenomenal. And no one heard about them, which was really cool, right?
Well, I was probably into DSM just a slight bit later. They were still fairly popular. But the issue for me was that when your car ran, it was the most fun thing ever. But when it's decided to stop running right in the middle of your day, there was that point where you had to really sit down and evaluate things. You know what's interesting? One of my friends, I guess the nostalgia piece, he just all of a sudden finds a 2G and he goes back and, you know, built motor, the whole thing. I mean, found a car that was clean, decided to salvage it, clean some stuff up. He brings this thing and he's like, listen, you got to drive this thing. You just got to drive it. And I remember my 2G being way better, I think, than it actually was. So fast as
I know what you're, I know what you're getting at.
I believe that even if I drove my old car today, it was just as fast as I remembered it. But what I don't remember was how horrible that they idle and how horrible they come to stops and like the little feather that you had in
transmission. Like I was just thinking of that the moment that you said that. I was like, man, that gearbox was just
tough. So there's a lot of things I loved about the DSM. There was questionably and arguably a few things that I absolutely just could not stand. But for the most part, you're right. It was a platform that was so iconic and so untouchable from everything else that was around. Maybe even until the Subarus really started getting popular.
Until, the Evos and Subarus came along. But, you know, the other thing that I would say was the community of DSMers was so huge. Like, I remember that I was on an email list and it was kind of like getting your morning mail when, you know, people would write these stories about going out V8 hunting with their DSMs and all this stuff. And it was so fantastic. And I think
it was real,
you know. Yeah. And that grew my passion for modifying cars so much because I would go to like these monthly meetups in Toronto and I'd see all these other DSMs and you just sit around and chat. And it was, you know, kind of a different time because now I feel it's more of the, okay, who's got the lowest car? Who's got like the widest wheels? And back then it was, you know, like, hey, So what are you doing to your car? How are you making it go faster? Oh, how are you fixing it? Like, what's the oil to run to, you know, to get rid of the notchy transmission? And
there was no not like that. You know what I mean?
No. And it was just such a great community. And maybe that's what it was, right? Versus maybe the Honda guys were the same, but that's what I remember. Like the community that I grew up with into my 20s,
right,
of the DSMs. Like I owned probably 12 DSMs in my time. And it was just like such a love affair with them until I got an S chassis, right?
Yeah. Listen, I get it. And the one thing about the community that was really interesting was they had all the tips and the tricks. And, you know, it's interesting. It's like people think, like, I think when the average car person, maybe even today more so, when they hear things like, oh, I blew a head gasket, it's like, oh, well, what shop? Like, oh, when's it going to be out of the shop? And this, that, the other thing. For the most part, I know there's plenty of guys, you know, hopefully listening that are like, oh, I do this stuff myself all the time. But
yeah,
like, I remember, like, I even had went to the extreme. I remember being on the Long Island Expressway and having to help my friend change his head gasket there because it was like,
oh, wow.
Well, why change a – listen, we had it down to a science. It really was one of those things. But, like, the truth was, he, you know, he was in the grass area and we were like, well, what are we going to do, pay for a tow truck? I mean, if, you know, you didn't have any money for tow trucks.
No, exactly. Yeah. No. And it wasn't that complex a job. Like those engines were still simple enough, right? Like very there wasn't all this variable valve timing. It was just like pull the timing belt out. And it was still tight, but it was not that bad a job.
Half these cars, I mean, at that point, no AC, that was gone. Like, some of the guys
had even – balance shafts gone. All that.
Like, I mean, there wasn't much there. I mean, and if you had another belt – I mean, you can have that head off lickety split. You just cut that belt and start moving some stuff out of your way. And next thing you know, you were on your way putting things back together. What drove you to become, and well, I don't think that's the right question because I kind of know the story a little bit. But what got you to the point where you were a magazine editor? You went right from car enthusiast to magazine editor. How did that happen?
Yeah, and it actually happened through the DSM community. So I went to school for film and had graduated and was about to try to find a job in the film industry. Like I love doing motion graphics and like that kind of stuff. So I was looking at post-production houses and one of the guys, Dave Pankew, you know him.
Yeah, of course.
So he also was a DSM guy and he was a part of the car club and said to me, hey, you know what, like, give me your resume. I'll send it out to a couple people in the film industry that I know and maybe I can help you out. And you know, a month later, he hit me up and said, hey, listen, like, we're actually looking for an editor, junior editor at the magazine. Would you be interested in this? And it was a really tough. It's like a pivotal decision in a life, right? Like I had just gone to school for 4 years and spent a bunch of money doing that and really liked it. But then on the other side, there was like my passion and what I really enjoyed doing in my spare time. That was like the dangling carrot as this could potentially be a career. But the one thing I'll tell you is I hated writing. I was very nervous. I wasn't a confident writer. So this was like, oh my goodness, you know, now I'm gonna have to write for a living. Like, can I do this, right?
On deadline, no less.
Yeah. And I had never, like, you know, the only thing I wrote in film school was a bunch of scripts and that was it.
Right.
So it's not like I was going to jump in there and be able to do that. But they had me put together a story, like a tech article, and it was good enough to their standards. And I said, you know, these opportunities do not come up often. And I went for it and just it spiraled from there, right?
You talked about going to film school. Do you think that your film school has helped you with some of your Speed Academy venture?
Oh, yeah, for sure. 100%. Like that was one of the reasons why we also said, you know, let's do a YouTube channel. Cause I already knew how to edit.
Okay.
I just had a good idea of like concepts of putting together stories, you know, and just small little things like composition and whatnot. Like I loved when I was in film school, that was the other thing I loved, like director of photography work and all that jazz. So I kind of felt I had a good eye for that and I could really just put together stories quickly and easily for YouTube.
If you did not become a magazine editor, you'd finished your film school, where do you think you would have gotten a job? Like where would you have landed?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I sometimes think about that. And I probably would have went and worked at a post house.
Right.
Logged footage for about a year or two. And then I thought I would You know, eventually they give me some graphic jobs and I'd work my way up. And eventually, you know, I could be working at a post house right now, either in a high level position or own my own post house business in terms of doing that. I don't necessarily know if that would have been there, but something along those lines, because I've always had this idea that I want to be my own boss or run my own business in that sense.
Well, you checked the box, I guess, with your current
It's situation. Interesting, though, because, you know, there's I meet people all over, and it's hard sometimes to explain to them what you do, because, you know, if you say you're a YouTuber, that doesn't necessarily sound like a real job, right? So my designation is I run an automotive media business, and, and hopefully people kind of are like, well, what's that? Oh, well, I make YouTube videos, I create and content for a website. And I think that kind of like gives them a better idea of, you know, what I do versus just, because there's still people out there that think me and Dave do this as like, you know, our little hobby on the side. Yeah, we're rich businessmen, as someone had mentioned once.
That's got to be one of the things that's the toughest to overcome. Not maybe now as much as when you get started, right? So you get started and it's like half these guys are like, wait, you want to charge us to do this? They're like, I don't understand.
Big time. And especially when you don't have an audience, right? Like, thankfully, our big advantage was that we came from the magazine world. So we had contacts, you know, such as yourself and all these people that kind of knew and weren't necessarily sure about the product that we were going to put out, but knew that we were going to do a good job of representing their company and, you know, helping promote their product. And I think that was what led us kind of into the foray. And Scion Canada came on board the first year. So with a Scion FRS build that we took to Targa, Newfoundland, which is a super cool race. And, you know, even though we didn't have many views, they saw this opportunity and said, you know what, this is a good way to promote this car.
How long were you officially a magazine editor for? I mean, I think it's got to be 10 years.
Yeah, it was like 11 years.
Man. So with Modified, you were really the driving force behind the content, especially in the latter 5-6 years.
Yeah. I literally moved my way up. I started as junior editor, then went to editor, and then tech editor, and then eventually editor in chief.
Well, and so if people get an idea of how committed and dedicated you were to that book and not just the job, it was in Canada originally. We said that already. But you, like when Source Interlink, I believe, bought Mod, right? When Source Interlink took over, you basically had to up and move.
Yeah. It was 2009. And they came to me and said, well, we're basically closing the office down. You have two choices. You can go to the unemployment line or you can move to California.
Right. And you went for what, 5 years, 4 years?
Yeah, 4 years. Yeah.
Man.
09 to 14, essentially. So
that's a big pickup. I mean, I don't know if anybody can. To me, that's this almost the same as me picking up and going from, you know, because I'm on the East Coast going to the West Coast.
Yeah. Right?
But then you went internationally. So there's like that level of competition.
Yeah. And truth be told, it was, you know, at an age where I think I was 28 or 29 years old. So I was already kind of grounded here. So it wasn't like I was 22 and bam, I could just like, you know, pack a car and go, which I did. But still, it was a little bit tougher in that sense. And I knew going down there that it was going to be a more difficult integration, but I loved it. Like, California is definitely the mecca of all automotive. It is a special place in that sense. You know, like the weather spoils you from where I live here. Like it's me and Dave have this talk all the time. Like if we lived in California, A, how much further our business would be, and B, the amount of time we would have to be able to go to the racetrack, right? Like, it's phenomenal. So,
but there are some
drawbacks, right? Yeah, exactly.
Way worse where you are. Like, even if you were down here a little bit, you extend your season. But your season is extremely short. I mean, Canada has that window, that hard window.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we're kind of, for a lot of people that don't know, we're lined up with Chicago. So our weather is almost Chicago-like. But recently, like, our winters, everything shifted. So we're pushing into the track, like we're at the track until November now, almost December.
Right.
But the season starts later, you know, like 2 days ago was the first day I drove my Porsche. And yeah, I could have probably taken it out 3 weeks prior, but it's still like, you just, April hits and there's always a freak snowstorm that comes in, and there's always people that just put on their summer tires too soon. So, you know, like it's shifted a little bit, and what we do, it condenses our season so much. So we have to get all our track stuff done in such a short amount of time now. But you know, it is what it is. Your environment is where you kind of have to figure out how to make it work to the best of your ability.
One thing we can't leave out is the time at Modified. There's, you know, for so many car people, having a magazine feature was more than exposure. It was a life goal.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And, I mean, that time may have changed and moved on. There's still some people that are kind of holding on to it, which is going to be tough because there's not as many pages there for you to have a chance at getting it.
Well, like the cachet isn't there anymore, right? Like that's the problem.
Of course. I mean, that was very much a status symbol. But what I still think is interesting is, what was it like as an editor having to choose your feature vehicles?
You know, it wasn't that hard for me. I feel
did you have such an influx? You just kind of looked at them and said, man, that's dope. We're going to shoot that.
Yeah, that was the thing. There was always cars. There was always people submitting stuff. And, you know, I felt like I ran a magazine that was very close to the grassroots segment. So I wasn't afraid of showing a car that didn't have, like, you know, a perfectly painted engine bay, that wasn't polished, like full show car. And I think Super Street, you know, I'm sure for Johnny and Charles and all those guys, it was much more difficult because they really needed that show car
echelon level.
Yeah, I was like, yo, if this is a cool car, you know, even if it had a little bit of body issues, it was still worthwhile showing, because to me it was more of like the build process and the function of the vehicle than so much of how it looked. And don't get me wrong, like to me, the car still needed to look good, but there was a lot more kind of like substance rather than just...
But different looks, because you're very much like me as far as taste. Like I'm the very clean, I don't really need a body kit, but give me a really hard stance, an aggressive tire that actually is function and uses the entire contact patch. Give me something that fills out that, you know, that gives me a little bubble on the tire, but gives me that fills out the fender well. Give me that car that's lowered, but has quality parts on it that is really aggressive and makes a gob of power. You give me that and I can look over everything else.
Yeah. And I always found like very few body kits really made cars look better to a certain extent, you know, like if you think back to those Arabuni days, man, like I cringed at that stuff, and there were so many people that were running them, and I don't know if that was just like a fad thing or people really thought they looked good, but I knew, like when I saw those cars, I was like, these cars are not gonna be cool in 5 years, right? Like this stuff is just gonna fade away as a fad. So maybe that was my little, you know, advantage and edge that I had to a certain extent. But
you came in right. Well, listen, your height of editorialness came in right after that Fast and the Furious boom and cascade downward a little bit. So, and that's kind of, I think, where we align. We're like right at that same age and career level as far as years in. And so I think we have that same type of appeal. I think being from the East Coast is also something that has, you know, changed our view a little bit. You have a lot more West Coast exposure, but you know, I think that for me, it's always been about having a real car. I mean, I have a 350Z now, you know, it's twin turboed and it's got some, you know, a lot of stuff on it, but like, I can't help myself. Like even when I do a bunch of stuff, like right now, I just got one of those Fortune Auto, you know, we did 500s
the hydraulic HLS system.
So, super, I mean, cool. They call it, I think, that APLS or anyhow, but bottom line is, so it's an airlift cup that goes on top of the coilover, and I've been racking my brain, taking things apart and trying to measure. I want to hide this thing in a way so it looks like it was factory installed. Just don't, like, I'm not the guy that wants to put something in the back of my window that's like, hey, it's polished chrome, it's, you know, it's a polished tank, come look at my stuff.
You know what I call that? To me, it's OEM plus, and that's always kind of been my motto.
OEM plus, I like
that. It's just like, you know, build a car that looks OEM, where if someone pulls up next to you, they look at it and they're like, okay, there's something going on, but I don't know what. Versus, you know, like you said, where you pull up and the guy's got the neon lights, he's got the big tank in the back and whatnot. Like, I've never been a flashy person. I've always tried to stay understated, and I think that kind of like shows in my taste in cars as well, right?
Do you have any good recollections of just absolute drama filled features. Like, you go to shoot a feature and the car doesn't run. You go to shoot a feature and it's not even close to what was advertised to you.
You know, I mean, I have a pretty funny story. One time, this kind of sticks out. It's always stuck to me. So we were going to shoot this FDRX7 out of, I think it was Alabama. I was super clean and whatnot. And he was like, hey, can you get me some tires? I said, you know what? Yeah, sure. I'll get you some R888s. But if I do that, I want a cool smoky burnout for the video shoot or for the cover photo.
Right.
And he said, sure, no problem. So I sent my photographer out and right away I get a phone call. And he's like, oh man, bad news. This guy tried to do a burnout and he blew up his diff.
Oh no.
Yeah. And I felt so bad. And
they're sticky.
Like, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I got to talking to him afterwards and exactly, he said, man, these things just gripped so bad. It just aided my diff right away. And funny enough, he fixed it 2 weeks later. They, you know, smartened up, put a little bit of water down and
right.
got the shot. And it worked out like a really great photo. To me, it was kind of like a hot rod style image with like the big smoky burnout in the back and the car was like moving forward slowly. So
do you have any recollections of like the worst feature you ever had, like the most drama filled feature that you ever had to shoot?
I don't, you know, most of the stuff was like, there was really no drama because I saw the cars, the photos of the car. There was never really any misrepresentation. Sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, there was engine bays. I was pretty good. Like, I was very diligent. I wouldn't go on a whim where if some guy said, hey, this is the car. And my big thing was I wouldn't wait 6 months to shoot a car. So if a guy sent me photos, I was on it right away.
Right.
Because, yeah, that's when a guy goes and repaints it and hits up every sponsor and then shows up with a car covered in stickers, right?
Oh, so, I know. Yeah.
But, yeah, my memory's not that good these days. So
right, I mean, yeah, it's been a minute. I want, before we move off of Modified.
Yeah.
It was just such a big piece of your life. What did Modified mean to you? To me, like, I became to know you as the face of the brand, and not just because you're the editor, but because Modified was one of my favorite books. And when I would read Modified, I really, like, I almost could hear you writing the words.
Yeah. Right?
And good. I know you personally, but like, what did it mean to you? Tell people, you know, I just think people should understand that, like, this was more than a job.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. It was actually like the largest part of my life.
Right.
You know, it, ironically, some people go home from a job, they sit down and they have, you know, passions for cooking or gardening or whatever it is, video games. That job never stopped. So for me, you know, when I went home, it wasn't like I sat down and, like I said, did some gardening or something. No, I was like looking at car stuff. I was like, you know, the whole eat, live, sleep kind of thing. I did that for, you know, the better part of a decade running that magazine. And I think that's why it kind of connected to people such as yourself that were in that same realm, because I really dedicated so much more of my time than I would say the average person would to a job like that. And but you needed to, because a lot of the other guys too, they did the same thing. Like, it was really such a passion driven job. And my biggest regret is that the company never treated it that way. We were a very disposable asset. We were never, you know, compensated properly. There was always just talk of, oh, well, you'll have a weekend off if you work 4 weekends in a row, or don't worry, there's a raise coming. And there was never really any of that. And that's really what I think soured a lot of the people in the atmosphere at a company like that, that owns so many of these magazines, right?
Well, and because what they didn't, and this is always, you could always see this, when the talent pool was fired, let go, transitioned, even editors that made their own choice to move on. When those things happened, the magazine always, not the magazine, but any of those magazines, they always transition. They always change their entire lineup. And you realize that one person really was the soul of it. So I think when you have editorial or content that does very well within a given period of time, looking at who that editor was or who those staff were, or the contributor editors that were repeating on those books, they were not only the voice, but they were the entire
book. Yeah.
You know, was everything. They were the ones looking for cars. They were the ones shooting cars. They were the ones, you know, talking to people. They were the ones deciding, you know, what your book looked like when you read it. So,
yeah. No, 100%.
That wasn't the company. That was these individuals, these editors. So it's unfair sometimes that, you know, and there's a lot of reasons that changes are made, and, you know, maybe for the better sometimes.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, you know, honestly, the magazine business, so few people actually understood how it worked and how expensive it was and how inefficient it was. Like, you know, when we had a sell-through rate of 30%, that was considered good. So 70%. Of the magazines were being scrapped,
shredded,
were never sold. Yeah. You know, like, that business model is a disaster to begin with. So it worked for a good period of time until, you know, the digital era came along and really crushed it. And that's because the efficiency of digital is so much better and so much cheaper and so much quicker than anything that a print magazine could bring.
Right. Unfortunately, you know what? Unfortunately is not the right word. It's going to get faster and faster and faster. The standard, the standard at which people are consuming media and content has never been faster before. Oh. And what's interesting for me is, you know, people say, well, why do you do the podcast? I mean, of course, there's part of it, which is that we get to bring you some really interesting stories. The other part of it is that you have to be a media company first and whatever you sell or do second.
Yeah.
That's the way things work today.
Yeah. And the way which you said, like the amount of content that is being consumed, you know, we just had a meeting with one of our YouTube reps, and I wish I remember the stat, but it was something ridiculous in terms of how many hours of footage are uploaded a day. And I want to say in, you know, the thousands of hours,
yeah,
or billions or whatever it was, of footage are uploaded a day. So you have to understand, like, the algorithm that this company has to use to filter this stuff out, to send you a video that you like, is so complex and whatnot. And it's kind of crazy. Like, if you look at television, there's a finite amount of time that you can fill with those slots. And that's why it costs so much to produce. And that's why the shows are good. Tomorrow, if you want to start a YouTube channel, you can start a YouTube channel and you can post it. Your friend can post it. And there's no real limit. The only thing that happens is, like, the signal to noise ratio just starts getting adjusted, right? Where there's a finite amount of people, a finite time that you have to watch, but there's so much content growing. So it's a very interesting yet daunting realm for me to be in, because you know, I'm always thinking, well, how do you kind of, like, channel your content towards the people that you think are your audience, right? And you hope that my employer, YouTube, to a certain extent, does that, but I just have to kind of have a leap of faith and say, well, they're going to find the right people for me, right?
Well, and there's a very real possibility that that whole model will change or diffuse. 100%,
yeah.
And it's got to be one of the big fears you have constantly.
Yeah, big time.
If the algorithm is to change, if somebody was to go to a point where all of a sudden you start losing views and things start to go awry.
Or YouTube says, you know what, like, we're not going to pay you as much anymore. And Twitch or whatever new emerging company says, we're going to pay you double, right?
Right.
So then you, all right, do we migrate our content? Do we go here? Are we going to be the first ones on, right? Like, there is this weird realm, because there's a lot of people that are super successful on YouTube, but there's a lot more that aren't. And the moment that, you know, there is a transition, if someone comes and says, listen, we'll triple your ad rates of what YouTube pays you, so, and, you know, we don't have a 5 million sub channel, well, does it really make, we might want to go there, because that could be the next venture. We could be the next, you know, Mighty Car Mods on that platform. And it's daunting, and you don't really know. It's kind of nerve wracking. And even with automobiles, like, how long are automobiles going to be around? Can I continue to do this for the next 10, 15 years? Like, yes, they will be, but at what capacity? Like, will
and
the
what's next?
Car? Right. Exactly. Like, will automated cars be it? Will electric cars be it? It's all unknown, but really the world is that these days anyways, right? Like, everything's moving a mile a minute.
Yeah. I think the hardest part is that when you really sit down and you try to figure out, you know, where you should spend your time or what you should consume, there's so many people that are, like you said, the noise ratio is incredible, and it's going to get more and more. I mean, listen, the fact of the matter is if you ask some kids between 7 and 11 years old, 12 years old, 13 years old, what they want to do for a living, getting the answer back right now, I want to be a social influencer, is not, or I want to make a YouTube, I want to have a YouTube channel. That was laughable 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Right now, that's like, oh, well, maybe.
Yeah, but, it's something, it's definitely, yeah, it's the realm of possibility these days.
But the
right?
one thing that really drives me nuts, and it's a personal pet peeve, so remember this has nothing to do with anything, but we just get so many people that their whole reasoning for they should get sponsorship or they should be entitled to something is I have 10,000 followers or I have, you know, 1,200 followers or I have a YouTube channel. And then you go to their YouTube channel and they have 737 subscribers.
Right. Yeah.
Just because you can create content and push it out to people and 12 people comment doesn't mean that you're going to be successful in this. And this is something that people really need to evaluate about themselves. You know, self-awareness is going to be one of the biggest pieces here because there's a lot of people that will do YouTube. There's a lot of people that will have decent content on YouTube. The problem is not everybody is going to click with an audience and not everybody is going to grow.
100%, yeah.
You know, I mean, listen, there's a lot of people that play basketball. It doesn't mean that how many of them make it to the NBA.
Yeah. I think your odds of up here in Canada to make the NHL, your odds are better being struck by lightning now, right?
Right. So
that's what it is. But that's kind of the realm of everything. Everything is at such a high level now, and you really need to work exceptionally hard to kind of get there, right? And for us, that's always been it with Speed Academy. We continue to put so many hours into this thing, and you know, we have good faith that this is all going to work out. We're, you know, going to be successful and whatnot, but it's still an incredibly difficult and hard road up. You know, up until last year, we were working out of a chicken coop that was converted into a storage space, which we converted into a shop space. Right. So
Pete, do you call yourself a social influencer?
No, I don't. No.
Do you call yourself a YouTuber?
No, I don't do that either.
You know, it's funny.
I'm becoming more comfortable with using that. It's still very odd to me because, you know, just my own personal insecurity with it is it just seems like a very childish, young thing to do. And I consider myself old already in this industry. So,
well, it's funny. It's like, it's kind of like the term entrepreneur, right? Like,
yeah,
it used to be one of those things when you said that that meant you were unemployed. And now it's like, that's cool.
The next starting company. Yeah,
exactly. So Speed Academy to me falls under a few unique things, right? First, technically you're a YouTuber, technically you're a social influencer. But the way you guys have structured your content and how you distribute your content is very different from most of them out there. And the reason is because you guys both come from an editorial background.
Yes.
So a lot of your content, of course, there's a lot of channels out there doing how-to videos. But because you do a much more episodic type show and because you guys have more of a series base, it's almost like little mini television shows and build-offs. But you can see where the editorial base comes from, and you have the Speed Academy website that allows you to put a lot of other written content along with those videos.
Right.
So it's interesting that I think Speed Academy falls in a very unique category because it really isn't just one of those things. You're not just YouTubers. You're not just an editorial site. You're not just social influencers. You kind of have this wide realm. Do you see the content and how you guys are developing the content? Do you see that changing? Do you have like this long-term plan that you think is going to evolve into something different than it is today?
That's such a tough question. You know, and I always, like, I literally think about that daily in terms of, you know, like you said, we do create very episodic videos versus a vlog style. And right now, the trend and the reward for views is to be vloggy, to create daily content, right? Exactly. The more content you can get out there, like we talked about this before, it doesn't necessarily matter what you're creating, as long as you have people that are following you and that are into you as the person, the influencer,
yeah,
they'll watch your stuff. And so because of that, we are struggling because we like to create very episodic content that's full of, you know, how to's or builds, and those take a lot more time than, you know, showing you what I made for breakfast and going to the shop, installing an exhaust system, showing the exhaust tips, video done, driving home, right?
Right.
So because of that, it's tough to know whether that content, we should change it and do more vloggy style, or whether it's going to change next year to something different. Like, it, to me, the core of Speed Academy has always been create content that educates people, but does it in a fun way. Exactly. Yeah. So it's not too heavy, right? Like, that was my biggest gripe when I was working at the magazine, is the tech articles. Like, there were some really great guys we had writing for us that were engineers and whatnot, but they would put you to bed.
Yeah.
And, you know, as much as I love D-Sport, like, there's so much, Mike's stuff sometimes is so technical that there's such a small percentage of the population that really wants to know, you know, the piston or to wall clearance on a B series motor. Like, they give that to people to do, right? And so we always looked at it and said, okay, how do we appeal to a broader audience? And that's kind of what we try to do, is we don't go too hardcore, but we still give you enough where it's like the average guy at home can do that. And I think we'll always stick with that kind of content generation. I think, you know, ideally my goal is to be able to hire a videographer so that, you know, me and Dave can always be on camera, and then we don't always have to focus like, okay, let's stop here.
Right.
Like, we were putting on a wing on the S2000. I'm like, okay, I got to hold this myself. All right, you hold the camera, and then I'm going to try to, you know, put the screw underneath, and it's this weird thing going on where you really could use two people, right?
Well, and the funny part about it is, if you watch a lot of your videos, if one person's in front of the camera, you know where the other person is.
Yeah,
exactly. Right? Like, it's no, if you see Dave on camera, there's a good chance that Pete's filming.
Yeah, right? I'm the god speaking from above.
That's right.
Yeah.
Take me through an average day. Everybody has those good days at work, those bad days at work, but what does your average day at work look like?
My average day involves commuting about 40 minutes to an hour to the workshop. It's too far for me personally. Like, I did the California thing, and I've watched people travel and commute and waste so much of their life doing that. And so right now, like, my priority right now is to change that and just like get a little bit closer. So it's like 30 minutes and whatnot. But, once we get there, we'll just do a quick rundown of what we're going to do. Sometimes we'll have something planned already, or sometimes it's just like, show up. Okay, so today we're working on the 240SX. So what are we picking up on? And we shoot the video. But there's so much more. Like, the big thing that I think people don't see is behind the scenes and like having to actually run a business. Like, today I had to spend about 5 hours doing accounting.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more than I love than accounting. Because accounting is just so great, and and inputting receipts and then looking at what did I spend? Oh, what's this transaction from last month? I don't remember. Oh, let me go, you know, like that. And then, you know, I'm sure you know the whole parts wrangling game. Like, because we come from editorial and YouTube isn't paying us, you know, $20,000 a month.
Yeah.
It's not like we just go buy parts. So a lot of it is like, hey, let me email Scott from Koenig and say, look, Scott, we've got this project coming up. And that takes so much time and effort. And I'd say 30%, almost 40% of our time is spent, you know, emailing, just kind of like planning that stuff. And then stuff doesn't go right. And then parts don't arrive. People don't get back to you. So it's so much more, right?
And that's the interesting thing. Like, when you own a shop, if you own a, you know, if you're one of those guys listening right now that has a shop, or, you know, is really close to a shop, they have, and I'm going to say the luxury, but they have the luxury of when they need a part, they call a Turn 14, they call a Motivicity, they call, you know, their local part place, and they order the part. And because they're paying for the part, the part shows up, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 days or whatever it may be, and they at least have a time there. But you guys have to start way far ahead. You're going to do a build. Because the thing is, you know, when you call Scott at Koenig, I mean, for the most part, I try to be as good as I can because I understand the struggle about getting stuff out. But there's plenty of companies that you're going to call And you were to say, hey, you know, do you want to do this whole thing? And after going back and forth with them for a week or longer, they finally are like, hey, you know what? We're in. We're going to do it. And they're going to send you these parts that you need. And then you're like, great. And you give them the address and you hope that they're in the mail. But the truth is, sometimes, you know, a couple weeks later, you follow up, right?
Something comes up, they forget, yeah.
And they're like, oh, my bad, let me get that out. And then 2 weeks later, you're like, hey, you know, do you happen to have that tracking number? And they're like, oh, I'm super sorry, it's going out now. So now you're a month ahead, and really all, you know, let's say you're waiting for, you know, a clutch or a part that's maybe not monumental, but all those parts add up for you. If you bought those parts, I mean, because you guys aren't, it's not like you're selling these cars at the end or these big things. I mean, it's catastrophic. You'd burn through money so quickly, you wouldn't be able to continue to produce content.
Well, and that's kind of the whole thing is we really rely on the support from parts manufacturers and companies to keep this thing going through that. Because if we did have to buy every little item, you know, there would be just losses so badly that I don't think we'd be in business. Right. But because of that, we do. However, the flip side is exactly what you said. There's just so much struggle. Some companies are great, but I get it. Like, listen, I know you got a job to do. Sure. I know, you know, me emailing you saying, hey, I need a set of wheels doesn't necessarily come up as the priority thing for you to do. Like, you have really those wheels aren't going to make or break your business or your job. So
no.
I get that. And I completely understand that. And that's why we're so understanding and compliant with, you know, waiting around and whatnot. However, it does affect our schedule, and more so it makes it hard to film a lot of videos consistently. So if we're waiting for something, right, then it's like, okay. And my biggest thing right now is I want to make sure we try to produce more content.
Right.
So we produce 2 videos a week. I want to try to go to 3 videos a week to try to help, you know, the channel grow, because more is better right now. Of course. It's just, I look at it, I'm like, it's such a daunting task to think how I'm going to produce another video. We're already, you know, it's like having the pedal floored at 100%. How do you now try to extract more, right?
Yeah, it's overwhelming. And then you figure in the fact that it's one thing when you're building a car and you can take a piece of paper or, you know, a good, you know, chalk marker, and you can go out to the windshield of a car and you can write your punch list down and you can tape it to the window and say, hey, all right, so today we're going to do 1 through 6, and tomorrow we're going to do 8 through 12. But there is a curveball there when, one, you have to film it, and two, you have to find parts that are coming from all over the place that you're waiting on, but you don't really know when they're coming. You hope you know when they're coming, but they don't always show up. So you have to go out of order, but you're trying to film in an order, because if you put it out, if you put the episodic out of order, it doesn't make sense. Exactly. Right? There's like a whole struggle.
Oh, there's, and just, so think of it this way too. How many times have you worked on a car? You said this job is going to take 20 minutes and it turns into 2 hours, right? Like we built a Ford Mustang, we put cams in it and everything timed up perfectly. It took us a week and I'm still miffed as to what happened, because everything was lined up, but the car, one bank would run and the other bank was off time by 180 and everything was lined up. So I must have had that whole timing system off probably 4 to 5 times. And if you know when you're doing a job and you got to go back and do it a second time, it sucks. Right. To do it a fourth time, a fifth time, you know, and then have that like punchy attitude, like, yeah, here we go, we're doing this all over again. And, you know, try to sell it as something great. And it just makes it difficult. And there's so much of these variables, like building cars is not easy. Aftermarket parts don't fit properly with other aftermarket parts. Yeah. Like there's so much that goes into it. So we unfortunately are, you know, in a business that requires a lot of troubleshooting and makes it more difficult than, you know, a channel that cooks.
Right. Well, and take that one example. So you had to go back and film and do that 4 times. So you're left with a choice as a content producer. One, bore your audience with doing it 4 times in a row, which after the first, you know, second time it's humorous and they're joking around and they cut it a little shorter and et cetera, et cetera. But you can't do that 4 times. So then your other option is just not to produce as much content, because now you have to physically turn the cameras off and go fix this thing, right?
Correct, yeah.
So that's a major dilemma. When your majority of your monetary substance comes from content getting pushed out, but you kind of get bound up in the daily rigors of actual problems or, you know, having a really bad day that doesn't, what does that bad day look like?
Right? Yeah, that's it exactly, right? And that's the frustration that you just have to deal with. And it's, you know, I mean, it's the same thing that most automobile guys deal with. If you're working on a car and you snap a bolt or, you know, something doesn't fit, you got to go do it. So, you know, for us, it just comes down to, we have to film everything. We're on a schedule. We're trying to get these cars done. Like, you know, we were supposed to start our drift builds, I think 2 months ago.
Right.
But, you know, everything else is the way the timing has happened. The K-Swap 240 that we're building is taking longer. And that's a great example. Like, it's such a fabrication heavy build where it takes me 4 hours, you know, to build all the brackets to install an oil cooler. So yeah, we've got one episode that we can pump out with an oil cooler installed, and people are like, okay, wow, you installed an oil cooler today, whoopty shit. Yeah. Versus, you know, now taking that, making it into a 30-second clip, adding it to another 30-second clip, and creating a 5-minute video, but that takes a week to then produce.
Right.
So it kind of is counterintuitive towards, like, we want to produce really good content, but same time, the algorithm right now is telling us you should be producing more content, not focus so much as quality, right? But the core for us has always been our quality, and that we are heavy on good content. So we're just like resisting as much as we can and trying to figure out, hey, how do we add a video without, you know, cheapening our product to a certain extent, right?
Well, and not
to help grow the channel.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And not to mention that the fact that any job that takes 20 minutes when you have to film it now takes an hour.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right? Exactly. Like, this isn't exactly like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm gonna change the spark plugs. By the time you line up this and get the shot ready, get the camera ready, get this, you ready to go? Okay, I'm ready to go. Ah, oh, crap, exactly. I said the wrong word. Start it over again. Like, yeah. I mean, this is one of those things that you very much, I mean, what kind of planning does it take? I think the most recent builds right now, currently at the time of listening, is Dave Celica.
Yeah.
And your 240.
Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of planning and time planning does it take to be able to prepare to start shooting that one of those, you know, builds?
So those builds are going on right now. I'm currently trying to round up parts for the last 3 months for these drift builds.
Right.
Right. And that's in hopes of when we do start those, they go quickly. And one of our most successful series we ever did was the K-Swap Civic at K-Tuned.
Right.
That was kind of an anomaly because you're literally in a place that has everything. So, right. oh, look, we're missing this. Oh, no problem. K-Tuned's got it on the shelf, you know?
Right.
And that was the beauty of that build, where it did take 5 days. And it was, if that was at our shop, that would have been a 3-week build easily.
Right. And not to mention that you would have been waiting for
parts, you would have installed. Yeah, exactly. So you had all these people come in and help, and it was kind of the perfect way to do that. And I wish we could do more of that, but logistically, that is very, very difficult to do. And how many parts companies out there do what K-Tune does, right? For a single vehicle, not many.
Yeah. No, for sure. How many builds do you think that you average a year so far?
Man, we're around, you know, we have a bunch of projects going on, but I think we build about 2 to 3 builds a year. And this year we kind of decided to go very fab heavy with the 240 and the Celica. And because of that, I feel like it's hindered us, because now there's so much of this like intensive build stuff going on, and not a lot of people are that interested in watching the stuff come together. They want results in action, right? Like, they want to see a car coming together, like what we did with the S2000. We tore it apart, put it back together with better parts, and it was an awesome, fast running car. And I think that's almost the better formula, but you kind of, you know, you don't want to do the same thing over and over.
Right. Do you guys own most of these cars? Do you purchase most of these cars?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
It's from my days of the magazine, like, you know, people would always, hey, why don't we do a turbo install on my car and all this stuff? And then things never go right. Or, you know, one time I had a guy's motor blow up. And he's like, oh, well, you know, we were doing this for the magazine, so are you going to help me rebuild a motor? And I was like, well, you know, and it's just like sticky stuff. So we don't do any on like major work. We still have friends that we help out here and there.
Pickup stories.
That help produce content. But all the cars we own, except the Scion FRS. So that was a Toyota car.
Well, different, right.
Lent us, but yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing. So then what happens? I mean, if you say we're building, let's say on average 2 or 3 cars a year, Is there always a plan to sell? Do we end up having a back warehouse full of cars?
Exactly. So that was our idea was always, let's keep these cars. You never know when you're going to use them. Right. But I need to invest in about five bend pack four posts at this point to house all the cars. Right.
Yeah.
So it's too much money from us. We're always looking at it and reminding ourselves, this is a business, and what's the smart business decision to do? And that's to sell these cars off, you know? And
right.
Like the S2000, we really went back and forth. Do we sell this car or do we not? But really we're at a point with it. It's been modified. There's not that much more that you can do from a sponsorship video perspective. Like, yeah, sure. Right. You could do a case and all this, but there's not that much interest from, you know, a manufacturer standpoint. So for us, from a revenue basis, it just doesn't make sense to keep that car. And we can always build another one. And then you kind of like start the process all over again versus having a car that's built. So like we're getting ready to sell that car in the near future, right? And almost with all the builds that we're going to do from now on, we've kind of said they will all be for sale because we just can't hoard these cars. We can't keep them around.
It's a tough issue to run into because the attention span of people has gotten so short that it's not like you can technically keep repurposing builds, even if you're doing different stories on them. People are like, ah, it's the same car. And they just, you lose their attention.
Right. You know? But the flip side is there's rabid fans that I know mm-hmm. for a fact.
Understood.
As soon as we sell the S2000, we had, you know, that was the first car that we built for this channel. There's a large portion of our audience that came to our channel because that were S2000. Build. Exactly. So they're going to be super disappointed. They're going to, you know, kind of feel let down. But again, for us, like we have to just keep moving forward and, you know, not trying to please everybody with cars that we've already built in that sense.
What are some cool builds that you still want to tackle?
I definitely want to do a Subaru build. I'm curious, you know, that crowd is just so passionate and so connected. I want to build one of those, and I actually want to see if they can be made reliable for daily use and with decent horsepower, because we work with a shop and we see them come in all the time with issues and whatnot. And everybody says they're unreliable. And, you know, as a previous Evo owner, I know how robust that engine is and how reliable and how awesome it works. And then the Subaru guys got to spend, in my opinion, at least, you know, twice as much money to get to where an Evo is and then worry with the reliability. So that's a build I want to do. Yeah, just unique stuff. I want to put more Ks into different cars. Like I've got a daily driver E28 that now that I've used a BMW transmission in my S chassis, I'm like, man, if I just put that motor in there, how cool would that be? Like 9,000 RPM, 87 5 Series ripping around, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I like, you know, that channel B is for build, you know, Chris?
Yeah, Chris. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I like Chris a lot.
I watch his stuff all the time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I love his content. And more than that, I like Chris as a person. I had the opportunity to meet him a few times and we've had some really good conversations, and it was my immediate love of just where he was coming from. Just that bond of a real car guy, really loving cars and doing some cool things because he could. Like, I like that more than anything else about his channel. And from that day on, he had our support. I mean, he has an open statement, you know, from me that's basically like, hey, if you need wheels, give me a shout. I mean, if you don't want to use our stuff, there's no pressure. Like, it's not like we don't have anything inked with him, no formal obligations. But I just know how fast he needs to turn over content. And it's like, if I can do something by helping you get a set of wheels out, I will. His stuff is just – it's. I mean, you saw that. Do you see the 240 project he's building now?
Yeah, it's incredible.
I mean
– yeah, and he has just – his rate at what he does, such a good job of creating videos and, you know, focusing on one build. And I think that's what captures a lot of the attention.
It does, yeah.
Where we have so much stuff going on and we have so many obligations to different cars and sponsors and whatnot that we're more, you know, like, oh, 2 weeks on the 240, then another 2 weeks on the S2000. And we're jumping around more, where Chris is amazing in terms of how he's focused. And that's because he doesn't come from the realm that we do, right? With the magazine business and how we always had 5-6 project cars on the go. And I admire how he does that. And he is just so great at putting out content. He just, like, you know, what he does in a day, he does so much and he cranks through it and then it's up. Like, he's been doing, I think, the daily vlog stuff for a while now, and it's amazing.
Yeah, the speed at which he goes is pretty intense. But you know, it's like, for your credit, if you had multiple vehicles going at one time, and let's say there was a clone pair of you and Dave and another, then it would be a really great thing, because you could turn out or stockpile content much quicker. But when you have those vehicles and you don't have the redundant talent, then all of a sudden, really what you have is simultaneous headaches, and you're just bouncing back and forth these projects trying to, all right, which one do we have the things to film the next episode on?
Yeah. And that's why we do have multiple projects, because you do need that. So when there is a lapse, you're waiting for a part. And, you know, we're not at a point right now where we can afford to buy everything we need. Like, we've been getting much better at it. You know, the other day, like, Vibrant is local to us. And instead of going to them to you know, get the freebie and ask for it, I just went to the store and bought it because I needed it really quickly.
Right now.
That is our goal, right? To get to a point where if we need something quickly, we can just go out and buy it versus, you know, having to wait, because it does slow us down. And then you're kind of like weighing your options. What's the better way? Spend $200, save $200 and wait 2 weeks, right?
Yeah. Do you ever worry about the backlash from certain enthusiasts when you, let's say you take on a Subaru build or you take on an S2000 build? You know, even if you guys, I mean, listen, we're all car guys, and there's a lot of things that are very standard, and you, I'm sure you do plenty of research before you dive into a build, and you have the luxury of having really great relationships and experts. But do you ever worry about the backlash from some of these hardcore enthusiasts when you take on a build that maybe you didn't do it exactly the way, you know, everybody does it? So all of a sudden, you kind of get this comment thing. It's like, you guys...
Oh, man. The comments are crazy, right? Like, everybody is an expert. Everybody knows what you should be doing, and you're always doing it wrong. You know, like, oh, my grandma's Mustang ran 13s. How are you guys not running 13s, right? But the reality is 95% of the population with a Mustang won't go out there in a stock Mustang and run 13s.
Yeah.
Yes, there are examples of that. And we're just showing the more common area where there's not a lot of traction. You know, there's all these different variables. And I find at first it was really difficult because you took a lot of the criticisms and whatnot to heart. But as you continue to build this content and you see that, you know, you just have to focus on what you're doing and what you think is right, because there's, to me, it's like a 10-to-1 ratio. For one person that posts, wow, that was fantastic, I love the way you did that, there's 10 people that post, oh, you didn't do it right, or oh, I wouldn't have used that part, or oh, you're an idiot, you know, that kind of stuff.
I wanna go back real quick. Can you tell people what it was like on that day in 2014 when you came in and that was it? I mean, it wasn't something that anybody suspected was going to happen, right?
There was a little bit of humming. Yeah, you never expect it. You always, you know, they always talk about it because it was a tough time. Like, the business wasn't doing well, and it wasn't just Modified. It was pretty much the whole company. Like, you know, they had closed a bunch of books prior, and it was, you know.
Were you in California at the time?
Yeah, I was in California. It was a very... I kind of was suspecting it more because they had come to me and said, hey, are you interested in, you know, in another job if it were not, right? So
first indication.
But it was, you know, part of it was uncertainty and not knowing what's going to happen. But the other part of it was almost a relief, right? Because I don't know. I don't necessarily consider a magazine job a very long-term thing in my eyes, especially the aftermarket stuff, because I saw the guys, and you know, you kind of get to the ranks of a magazine editor, and that's it. So I was kind of already at the top of where I was, and I really enjoyed doing it.
Right.
But the problem with that is you're kind of capped out on money and all that. And if you want to move up, then you just become this middleman. So, you know, there's like the middle management person in those companies.
Yep.
And then you don't really get to do all the fun stuff, which is build cars, go on these trips here and there you do. But really, you're just like Okay, the top tells you something. Yeah, and says, okay, well, why is this magazine not performing? Then I go to my editor-in-chief and say, hey, okay, so what are we doing here? Why is this not working?
Right.
I really didn't want to go into that position. And I knew that if I, you know, whether the magazine closed or not, there was a certain threshold that it would be time for me to move on, right? So in theory, it kind of came at a good time for me because I had just spent 10 years doing it. And I was like, okay, I'm kind of at a point where I've learned everything I needed to learn from this business, from running a magazine. I'm ready for something new. This, you could just kind of see the writing on the wall. The print business is fading.
Yeah. What did the time look like between the time that you left Source Interlink and the time you started Speed Academy formally look like? I think it's interesting for people. There's so many people right now that are at that crossroads, whether they're coming out of college or they're car guys that are, maybe have a job or don't have a job. And they're like, look, I want to do something I love. I want to do something here. I don't really know what that is. But what does that time look like between the time you left Source Interlink and the time you kind of formally were like, yeah, we're doing this thing? What emotions went? What did you focus on? What were you doing every day?
It was just, well, you know, part of it was great to just have a little bit of a vacation, right? I'm sure everybody dreams about that. When you lose your job, you're like, I can take some time off. But right. There really wasn't much downtime because I was really focused right away in terms of, okay, so what is the next step? Like, you know, a lot of people transition from magazine to PR jobs. And I really wanted to do something on my own. And I thought, you know what? Like, there is a gap here. No other magazines produce technical content, much like we did. There's not a lot of websites like Speed Hunters that back then was just focused on feature cars. It was always, you know, what feature car, but there wasn't tech stuff going on. So we thought, you know what, why don't we create a website and then a YouTube channel that kind of fills this void where people such as yourself, if they want products featured, yeah, can come to us and say, hey, you know, do that. And because I had that focus early on, there wasn't a lot of uncertainty. It really was just like finances, right? Trying to figure out, okay, yeah, how am I going to last? But I had worked so hard at Source Interlink that I had built up a good nest egg where I was ready and prepared, you know, to live 2 to 3 years without making a salary and on a, you know, on ramen and right, pretty modest living in that sense. But it was just kind of a mindset, right? You got to make the commitment to something. And I think it's difficult these days too, because there's so many things to do. And like, I think of, man, if we were trying to start a YouTube channel right now, it would be daunting to think like, oh my God, there's so much content out there. And yeah, oh, my videos are only getting 100 views. Like, but you know what? We started like that 4 years ago.
Well, right? And that's the thing. Momentum is a interesting piece.
Yeah, it is. And you just have to go out and do it. If you're passionate about something, you know, go find a place that lets you do that. And whether that's cleaning dishes at a place or, you know, sweeping the floors at a mechanic shop and just getting your way in, like, I think that really can help you find your passion. Or maybe you'll tell yourself, that's not what I want to do, right?
Well, sure. Was there ever a point where after you started Speed Academy that you said, maybe I should just get another job?
There's never been that I'd get another job. There's been worries and thoughts of, you know, what I'm doing, like you said, is niche and, you know, like, who knows how long this stuff is going to be around. So from a long-term perspective, is this going to be able to last? But I love doing this stuff so much. I love automobiles and that's kind of the driving force. Anytime these fears come up, I always tell myself, you know what, this will work out. Like, I can always go back to living more modest if I need to. Like, life isn't bad per se. And I think we kind of take it for granted here where a lot of the world has it much worse.
Oh,
and yeah. Okay. So you know what? I got to go back to working in a chicken coop, not the end of the world if I had to do that. Right. But I still certainly have times where, in my other life, I'd be a furniture builder. That's what I've always wanted to do. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, there's more people that would probably buy chairs and tables than modified cars. So,
you know, it's funny that you say that. I actually, because I like welding, I like building, I like.
Yeah, exactly.
I had this whole thing. You ever see those shows that like they have the American restorations, or they take this cool like things like old barn doors and they turn them into tables. And like,
yeah,
I kind of like making, So like part of me is like, I love doing that. I just don't have any time. Like I have no time anywhere. So,
well, and that's a thing for a lot of people, right? And
sure.
That's to me, my point is if you want to do that, you can, if you're passionate enough, then, you know, you can, I think, take the chance and do that and start building it at home, list it up on Craigslist and see how it goes, you know, like that. If I had to start all over and I was getting into the furniture business, that is literally what I would do, is just start listing stuff up in the local ads and see how it goes, or go to for boutique furniture stores and give them my crooked table and they'll tell me how shitty it is. And then I go fix it. And five years later, you know, I've got a successful furniture company.
And then, then you start a YouTube channel about building furniture.
Exactly.
And,
there we
are. And while and you're back doing that, do you ever think that, within Speed Academy, that you guys have to spend even more time now on your brand in addition to just putting out the content, because the brand is the one thing that could potentially live on if the content shifts?
100%, yeah. Like, and, you know, Dave and I were talking about this. We focus so much on the production aspect, but, you know, we just missed Grid Life, which is a huge event. You know, that, how good is that for our business, right?
Right.
Let's say we create two less videos during the week, but we prep ourselves to go to Grid Life. Is it better to do that and expose the brand to so many more people than, you know, just continually create content? Is it more, should we be spending more time creating merchandise, right? Should we be focusing on our social media? Like, there's just so many outlets that you do need to focus on. And you do need to be diligent about it, but I always look at it from, you know, what is the core competence of what you do? And we still have to make videos at the end of the day. So we do make sacrifices where areas where, that I would love to do, but we just right now do not have the time, right? Like, I would love to be creating more merchandise because I do all the design and whatnot and like making sure the store is stocked, but that stuff just is difficult enough, right?
Well, and the thing is that in a perfect world, you'd love to be able to bring in some more bodies and have more people out there that are able to, you know, go and capture the, let's say, the Grid Life stuff. But the problem is that at some point, there's two pieces. One, you have to pay these people, and you guys are, you know, Dave's supporting a family, and you're supporting a, you know, well, a small little family.
Wife, yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
But the other piece is, too, is that, you know, you guys have kind of raised a baby. Right? You've developed something that you both share a vision on, that you probably have had interesting little battles on here and there, and you've kind of come to see, this is how our content goes, this is how we produce it. It is your content. So to release control to somebody else to go take that content to not be what you know it to be, that's a tough piece too.
Oh, big time. And I mean, Dave will be the first person to tell you that I'm very much a control freak in that sense. But that's because I have such a high standard of what I want to see produced, right? And we've talked about hiring somebody. So, you know, like the day-to-day things that we need to go pick up tires or mount wheels, like that kind of stuff. Yeah, you could have somebody, but then what does he do in between? So we thought, well, what if he was a camera guy? Okay. So then if we have a camera guy in, and because we only shoot probably like 3 days to 4 days a week. There's always a day that I'm at home working, Dave's at home working. So because of that, like, you know, it's really hard to find somebody that fits properly. And, you know, more so, you now have a body to manage. And that to me is, you know, I talk to so many people that run businesses, and it goes from, you know, you running a business. Yeah, you've got a successful business. You've got all this staff, but then it becomes like not the core competence of what you love to do, but managing people. And that really scares me from a certain extent, because I really love what I do. And I don't want to have 10 people and me, you know, talking to Jimmy today and telling him, okay, well, you're working on the Miata. Why aren't you doing it this way? Or, oh, Bob did it that way. So I don't know. Like, I kind of like our little bubble we're in, but we do have to grow eventually, right?
Yeah. It becomes that point. Like, where do you release control? But
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
No, I get that part. That's a hard thing. I mean, you guys are talking about a major transition that would have to happen, and to be able to continue to produce the same kind of content you do with the same quality level that you're kind of used to, It would be extremely difficult to do that while taking on a new entity. And really, there's no job position. You can't advertise that. You just have to keep looking for that perfect person.
Right. And it would be somebody that's enthusiastic, that wants to, you know, that's into cars and whatnot. And I think we'll get to that point. What you mentioned about, you know, it being a baby, that's what I still feel this business is. It's still at its infant stages. So once it gets to a point where, you know, we're more comfortable, we don't have this massive rush and anxiety, continue to produce content to build more subscribers, then we can kind of like look at it and say, okay, well, how do we do bring somebody into this mix? How do we, you know, maybe start a second video series that someone produces and we literally hire them on, right?
Yeah, I think that's the toughest part when a lot of your revenue stream is driven by content.
And driven by content that we create. Like if, you know, I subbed out for a month and somebody came in, it doesn't necessarily work and it may not be that easy, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. What is it like? I mean, especially for a guy like Dave, he's got a family. I mean, do you guys shoot long days? Do you shoot short days?
I mean, I wish our days could be a little bit longer, but yeah, Dave's got a family. You know, he's got two kids that are, I think, 7 and 5. So they require a lot of attention. And yeah, it's, you know, for him, it's so much more difficult. I do a lot of the grunt work. Like our days aren't necessarily that long because I have to commute in. And so they are shortened in that sense. I'd say, you know, we're still putting in 6 to 7 hours a day. Ideally, I would love to have an 8-hour workday. But then I think back, like, you know, when working at the magazine, it's kind of like, you know, if people put in 3-4 hours, that was a productive day for a lot of people. So
man, I think
we're, yeah, right. You know, so I think we're productive. It's just the rate that we need to create content and the way it's consumed is just so high that we have this anxiety, like we need to do more and more and more. Well, we're never really satisfied. I never feel content. Like, oh, you know what? Today was a great day. I got 5 hours of work done. I'm always like, no, why didn't we get 6 hours? You know, why didn't we get this finished?
Do you ever have any disagreements between the two of you that you're, you know, maybe the visions don't align, or was that more early days? Doesn't really happen.
You know what? Dave and I complement each other really well. And I think that's why our business success is there. I've watched a lot of YouTube channels start off with multiple people and slowly kind of disintegrate. People break off, you know, they have fights. I mean, the kids are younger, so I get it. Right. But we work pretty well and we're both very level-headed and rational people. So if I've got an idea that Dave doesn't like, he, you know, will tell me, well, what about this? And we eventually come to an agreement where it works for the both of us.
Over the next 1 to 3 years, what do you think that what's going to happen to that YouTube influencer scene? What do you feel from the inside of things?
My gut feeling is that it's still going to grow rapidly. Like the YouTube thing is continuing to become a bigger and bigger realm. And I can see already there's so many people that are doing this full time that it's just going to continue to grow. I think there's definitely going to be headaches in terms of revenue payment and whatnot, but the larger it gets, the more people are buying into it. Like I find companies are now starting to focus. I talk to more and more companies that are like, you know, the print stuff is just gone for me. I need to spend my money elsewhere. And they are turning to that. So I think where the money flows, the people will kind of flourish. And I still think there's a lot of people that don't have the internet in the world and they continue to, when they do get it, they're looking for video because video is that thing and relatable content is key, right? It's like going to the car show. Now the car scene is a bunch of guys that have cool cars with minimal mods, like slammed, whatever, going to car parks to a certain extent, you know, like the big shows with all the cars have kind of taken a step back to those kind of like car meets. And I think that's the same thing. Everybody wants this relatableness and YouTube brings that. So I believe it's just going to continue to flourish for the next little while, at least.
Right. Do you see a shift possibly coming in Twitch?
I don't know, man. I haven't done enough research. Like we looked at it for a bit and we're like, okay, can Twitch make a change and whatnot? I just didn't see it from a consumable point, like the way YouTube's set up.
Yeah, so, I mean, I personally think that Twitch will definitely be a major contender. I really do. And I think that it's going to start. There's one day there's going to be that shift of, you know, the monetization is just going to go on its head. And yeah. I think that may be the tipping point. And for the people that are there and have already grabbed a lot of that, you know, early moved over, you know, kind of base, I think that they're going to have the head start, you know, no different.
So what do you find about Twitch that makes it so appealing to you?
Well, I don't know if I would say it's appealing to me. First off, I'm not a gamer. So yeah. that's one of my negatives. And the hard part is the same way you have to go research, like that's my job too, right? I have to kind of see where people are going to end up and where they're going to be. It's one of the harder things to do because I'm not doing it for any self-motivation. I'm doing it kind of self-preservation. But, you know, for me, I think a lot of it is human behavior. Like, I think if you just watch where people's attention shift, mm-hmm. I think it's going to happen. It's happening right now. I think a lot of people are using Twitch, and right now it's so gaming centric, but I do believe that there's going to be a major shift, and you start to see some of the guys doing it there. I think,
yeah, Chris from B is for Build, right? Like, he's on there playing games all the time.
So I think it becomes that. I mean, the question is, when you think about YouTube, if there's any aggressor that could possibly be a good opponent to YouTube, there's only really one. And that's Amazon.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they have the size of scope. So for them to basically enable Twitch to turn into a regular video upload, you know, on the flip of a dime, they're right. The ones that could do it. And they have the monetization to be able to pull it off too. So that's a scary piece.
Yeah. I mean, I've also heard YouTube or Facebook is getting ready to set up some monetization for their videos. But like, I've lost faith in Facebook. I have such a hard time going there and actually finding good quality content. And so for me, it's kind of like it's been a lost cause. Like, I don't even spend much time on it. I'm more, you know, the Instagram is like the last social media thing for me that I find that I can really relate to and feel I could capture an audience and people still connect with, right? Where Facebook, to me, it's pretty dead.
So what I see as an advertiser is that I think that the Facebook ad tools are incredible. And what's happening right now to me is that their algorithm has been solely adjusted to be able to allow brand pages. Like, so what they're doing, to me, in my opinion, what's happened is all the people with individual pages, they've tailored the algorithm so that it tries to keep you interconnected to the people around you. It really tries to make sure your feed is consumed by your friends, your family, those close to you. And then they're letting the brands and the pages, because they've kind of degraded their natural organic reach, they've kind of let them have the ability to buy ads and target different people to be able to inject their content where they see fit into those feeds.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I think what's going to happen is, I believe it started to happen, as I think the shift is heavy and it's taken over Instagram. I don't know if you've seen your organic reach go down tremendously in the, let's say, last 2 months.
Yeah, no, I certainly have. Like, we were growing at a good pace, and now we're kind of stalled out, right? Yeah.
So and so I think that they're moving that same type of
algorithm. Oh, of course they will. Like, they want to make money, right?
Sure. And so the other thing is, I don't think that anybody should sleep on Mark Zuckerberg, because he's incredibly astute. And I think that when we talk about that whole video piece, it's a good point that you brought up, if there's anybody that could potentially turn things on their head, you know, aside from Amazon because of their size of scope, certainly it would be Facebook. They could easily launch a video platform that could rival YouTube.
Yeah, and really, you know, it does come down to money. If you can offer people to create content at a much more competitive rate than what YouTube does, man, it's going to be an easier sell for people to jump on board there, right? And of course, as with any new item, people are that company will be incentivized to give you those deals, right? The moment that it's just like with Uber, the moment that Lyft comes to town, we just had that happen where, you know, Uber's now offering incentives for their drivers because everybody was jumping ship going over there to stay with them, right? So to me, like, competition is just good. So I'd love to see another platform, because YouTube right now, they kind of feel they've got the monopoly, and they do. So why push, right? Why help creators to a certain extent? But at the same time, there's so many out there. Like, they're doing a good job. I don't knock YouTube for any sense, because, you know, at the scope of what they need to do, they're doing a fantastic job. Has it, you know, it's big frustrating job for me when the channel isn't growing as quickly as I want it to, but I get it, right?
Well, it's a big job. They got to balance being able to support the community and the content, you know, providers that are pumping out content, but they also have to be able to support these brands that are putting money into those channels and make sure that when they're spending money, they're getting what they need. So that's a tough balance. I don't envy them at all.
No.
Do you have any tips for anybody that might be a new YouTuber?
content. No, I still think it's a great platform. It's just, it's really, to me, difficult to get started, and it's discouraging, but, you know, create content that is engaging. You know, for example, if you want to get into the car realm right now, I would go and look at what's trending, and I'm sure the Civic Type R is up there. So if you have the means, go buy a Type R, build a Type R, right? Like, look at the cars that are trending or whatever is going on, and then kind of take that and run with it. Because otherwise, like, it's cool doing very niche builds, but you also have to consider, you know, a Celica All Track isn't necessarily a large scale item. If you start your build off with something like your channel off with one of those builds, it may be cool, but how much traction are you going to get versus Civic Type R, where, you know, we created two videos last summer of just comparing them versus an Integra Type R and a Civic Type R, and they blew up. And why is that? That's not necessarily because that content is any better than the other content on our page, but that's just because it was searched. So that video now gets fed into all of the popular channels and the popular areas, and people are like, oh, there's another Type R video, let's watch it.
Well, and it takes only one really good video to attract a whole bunch of subscription base.
Exactly. Yeah. If you can get that one video to really trend, it can certainly help. But I've seen it happen, you know, where people, Big Boost, who's a collaborator with
Albert
Z, right? Yeah. And he rode LZ's coattail, but then, you know, he has to still create his content. You can see it kind of like dipped a little bit when he wasn't doing as much with Adam. And that's the thing. Once you get started, you can't just rely on one video or one big thing. You just have to constantly continue to do it. And there are strategic ways. Like, if you see something that works for you, or you see, like I said, Type R stuff doing well, then focus on that, right? Yeah. Even though it might not be necessarily what you think you might want to do, it may be the right thing to do to grow the channel, right? Like, some of the builds we do aren't necessarily what we would love to do, but we said, you know what, like, this is a, like, when we built the Mustang, we thought, there's a ton of Mustang owners, why don't we build a Mustang? Would we have ever built a Mustang otherwise? No, we thought it was good for the business. Did it turn out to be? No. But, you know, we still thought, and we took that chance. And I think that's sometimes what you got to do, is like, look at what is better for the business versus what you personally want to do, right?
So I think that I've taken up a ton of your time, and I want to leave on a final thought, which is, where do you see Speed Academy 5 years from today?
As one of the larger YouTube channels that provides episodic, enthusiast-based content. Yeah. I definitely do. I think once we kind of hit our little sweet spot and we're exposed to a lot more people, I think we'll be a good success in that sense. Like, I view a lot of our content very close to Mighty Car Mods in what we do.
Sure.
And I think there's a very large audience for that kind of content. It's just us reaching that audience. That is our biggest hurdle right now, is we have yet to reach the masses.
It's the hardest part, is the distribution.
That's how it always is. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. It's the hardest part. Pete, I appreciate you doing this.
Anytime.
It's always a pleasure to speak to you, and I think I'm really hoping that people get some cool stories out of what you had to say.
I hope they enjoy it.
Why don't you tell people where to find you and Speed Academy and all your content, just in case we were under a rock?
Yeah, well, you can go to YouTube, search Speed Academy. You can go to our website, speed.academy, no.com on there. You can find me. You can always shoot me an email, peter@speed.academy. Our Instagram is, I think, @speedacademy. And our Facebook is Go Fast with Class, because Speed Academy was taken. But just search Speed Academy. We'll come up.
We'll be there. All right, that's it for this one. For more info on the podcast, head over to koenigwheels.com/podcast. You can also catch us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube @koenigwheelsusa. If you like what we're doing here, please subscribe. You can find us on iTunes and Google Play. That's it. We're out of here. Peace.